books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the programme all about audiobooks recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today, Rachel Greenlaw joins us once again, this time to tell us about the Woodsmoke Woman's Book of Spells. And I'll chat to blind poet Dave Steele about a new Austin's amazing adventure, The Big Test. All that plus some new books in the RNIB library coming up on today's Read On. Rachel Greenlaw's The Woodsmoke Woman's Book of Spells is a cosy new tale of witches, magic, mystery, family and romance. Rachel was last on Read On last year, talking about her books One Christmas Morning and her young adult book Compass and Blade, and we'll chat about both of them in a moment. But first of all, let's get a flavour for the Woodsmoke Woman's Book of Spells, the audio version of which is read by Kirsten Atherton.
I clutch the keys between my fingers. The cottage in front of me is quiet and watchful, small windows tucked into the folds of granite walls. I hesitate, taking a moment, feeling the edges of metal in my hand, the cold, damp air as I draw it down my throat, the light as it snatches at the October clouds above. I needed this moment. It's grown inside me like a nettle, this need, curling around me all these years, stinging me as I turned the other way. But now that the moment is here, I find it is full of ghosts. I turn the key in the lock and fumble with the handle, my fingers slipping over the worn iron and push. The hinges protest, but the door gives with a low sigh. Inside, it's dark and cold, so much colder than the outside world. I feel the cool air twine around me like an arm, guiding me in, pulling me past the doorway. Perhaps it is Ivy, my grandmother, welcoming me back. I let my eyes adjust, finding the wide flagstones, the crooked staircase, and I step over the threshold.
It follows the story of Carrie Morgan, who returns to her small hometown of Woodsmoke after 10 years away to renovate her late grandmother's cottage. And while she's there, she meets a man as the frost settles in late autumn, who her witchy family warn her might not be real, who might disappear as the frost thaws in spring, leaving her broken heart behind. And it's told from three perspectives, Carrie, Cora and Jess. And it's a story about belonging and what home truly means. It's also a love letter to nature and an exploration of stories passed down through generations and the ups and downs of motherhood.
My boots clatter on the floor, echoing down the hallway as I move past the staircase. I run a hand over the wood. Feel the smooth varnish, then the rough patches where time has worn it away. It's familiar in the way a dream is upon waking. I haven't been in this house in 10 years, and somehow it seems smaller, frailer than it did 10 years ago. Without the true owner of the place, singing in her sweet, reedy voice as she potters around, the cottage holds an air of neglect, of being left too long in the dark, all forgotten. I shake off the cold, drawing my coat a little tighter across my chest, and take the doorway on the left into the front room. The fireplace is littered with the remains of a bird's nest, and a chair lies on its side, as though hastily tipped over. I reach out and write it, but a leg comes off in my hands. Oh, Ivy, I sigh, dropping it back on the floorboards. I don't bother trying the light switch. The electrics won't work. Cora, my great-aunt, said as much in her letter. In a rush, I move to the next room, to the kitchen spread across the back, circling the old farmhouse table and peering out of the back windows. And there they are, the giants that loom over me in every dream, every nightmare. The reason, perhaps, that I have been running for so long.
Where do you think Woodsmoke is?
Oh gosh, now this is an interesting question, because I first got the idea after a writing retreat in the snowy mountains of Colorado. And I loved the kind of ominous presence of the mountains and the woods and the snow, how like beautiful it was, but how like stark and, you know, you just don't know what's there. It's just so vast. But also Woodsmoke is inspired, the actual small town of Woodsmoke is inspired by the town I grew up in rural North Cornwall. And it's also inspired by the kind of the landscape where I live on the Isles of Scilly, with all the kind of like nature trails that crisscross between fields and things, which is where Cora takes her dog Kep for a walk really often in the book. So I kind of put these all together and I made up an entirely fictional town, which I believe is somewhere in the UK.
Now tell us about the Morgan Compendium.
So the Morgan Compendium is the book of stories and recipes and spells that's passed down through generations of Morgan women who have all lived in Woodsmoke, and it's passed from grandmother to granddaughter, so it skips a generation. And it's a way of documenting things that happen in Woodsmoke, the women's stories of Woodsmoke, things that happen on the mountains. And there are small excerpts at the beginning of some of the chapters of some of the stories in the Morgan Compendium.
And there's a very thin line in the book, I think, between the real world and the magical. Was that a difficult tightrope to walk?
Well, it's really a reflection of how I feel about the natural places in our world and like the wild places. Because it's very often I will go on a walk in the winter on the Isles of Scilly when there's nobody else around, when it's a bit stormy or it's a bit foggy, and it just feels like I could turn my head and see something that any human would believe shouldn't exist. So it's that feeling that there is something around us that surrounds us that's just beyond our understanding, that we can't really explain with science or with modern thinking. And I wanted to capture that feeling, that essence, in this book.
Now, you said when you were last on with On Christmas Morning that that book was indirectly inspired by being in a lockdown. Was there a little more feeling of freedom in this book?
I think so. It's also a reflection of just how I feel about motherhood and also like what home and belonging means. And I especially think about this when I think of the island where I live, which is incredibly remote in the middle of the Atlantic. And I do feel a strong connection to here, but I also feel a strong connection to the mainland UK, where I lived 21 years of my life. And it's just that question of like, what is home and what is the place where we're meant to be, and is it a person or that we want to be tied to or that we feel we belong with, or is it the place itself that roots us? So I kind of explored that through each of the perspectives as well in the story.
Yeah, you don't make life easy for yourself. Your first book was multiple characters. This one's got three points of views in different timelines.
When I first wrote the manuscript, it was in a very different shape to how it is now. And with every single book that I have published, that I write, I always want to be testing myself and just kind of expanding my kind of abilities craft-wise. And so with this book, I wanted to see if it was possible to write a multi-POV story with a kind of a non-linear plot as well. And I worked with my editors to get it in a more coherent form so that a reader could read it and not be completely confused.
And you wrote the first draft of One Christmas Morning very quickly. Was it the same with this one?
No, it was not, definitely. So the Woodsmoke Women's Book of Spells, I wrote it in pieces, and I did think about it for a long time, and I kind of wrote it in between other projects like Compass and Blade, my YA fantasy, and it took quite a long time to kind of tease the secrets out of each of the characters and to really get under the skin of each of them. So it took a great deal longer. It probably took me about a year in between writing other projects, like dipping in and out, before I had a full first draft of it.
When I wake, winter has come. I fight my way out of the blankets, drawing in lungfuls of soothing air. It's stifling in the caravan. The walls too close, the ceiling too low. I drag a hand over my face, banishing the cobwebs of dreams, and shuffle around the small space, making coffee with the old whistling kettle, shrugging into my coat, pulling on my boots. I clutch the rough ceramic sides of my favourite coffee mug in my hands, the one I found in a small pottery in Ireland many years ago. I let the steam curl around my face. Then I step out into the frost.
Now, there are three points of views in the book. Was there ever a discussion to have three different audiobook narrators?
Oh, gosh. No, there wasn't. I actually, we were really lucky with the narrator that we've got. She's just phenomenal, and she's narrated so many fantastic audiobooks. So I'm really proud that she wanted to work on Onward Smoke. And I got an email from my UK editor, and she just said, you know, this is who's going to be the narrator, like, fantastic news. And I was like, yeah, it's brilliant. And I've listened to clips of it, and her voice is just so smooth and soothing, but it's got that like edge to it, and it just suits the book so perfectly, tonally. So I'm just so pleased that we've got this one narrator who has this range to produce all of the voices.
Let's have a listen.
The field is a painting. All I see are droplets of glitter. The ground, the middle distance, the sky overhead, sparkling with dew. Frost is a scent you cannot bottle. It's sweet and sharp all at once, laced with memories from childhood, from early morning breakfasts, from the moments my heart thumped with the knowing that it was here at last. I hold out my hand, my fingertips already nipped by cold. The chill draping the air is early for this time of year, not yet November. I smile for the first time since I arrived and breathe it in, that scent of frost and cold. And I'm sure, in that moment, that despite my long absence, despite the way I left this place and how it's haunted me ever since, this is my homecoming. This spell of early winter feels alive and wild with magic. The mountains have welcomed me home. After all.
Kirsten Atherton, reading from the Woodsfolk Woman's Book of Spells. Now, I'd hate putting things in boxes, but how would you describe the book? Would you say it was a love story or a mystery or a drama or somewhere in between?
I'm going to dodge this question a little bit. And I'm going to say, I feel it's genre blend. And I'm a big fan of genre blending stories because I feel like, as writers, we shouldn't box in our writing. But I know that that gives librarians and booksellers a real headache. But I feel it's women's fiction because it's a real exploration of women's voices and thoughts and feelings. But it's also a love story, and it's also a mystery. It's also speculative fiction. And so I've kind of taken bits out of several different genres and pieced them together to create what I wanted to create.
Now, what we'll miss if we download it from RNIB is the cover. Can you give us a little description of it?
Oh, of course. So actually, it's really stunning. So I will describe it in as much detail as I can so your listeners can build up a picture. The text, The Woodsmoke Women's Book of Spells, is picked out in gold lettering in the centre. And around the edge, there are flourishes also in gold. And if you turn the book, it glints in the sunlight. And around the text that says The Woodsmoke Women's Book of Spells, there are feathers, crescent moons, some more flourishes in navy blue. There's also the mountains at the top with the sun rising above it. And the tagline along the top says, "Love can be a curse." And then we've got a gorgeous quote from Cecilia Ahern, and it says, "Magical, I absolutely treasured it."
Another of Rachel Greenlaw's books available from the RNIB Library is Compass and Blade, read by Lizzie Waterworth.
The thunder sends me running as lightning cleaves the sky, casting a flash across the sand. I see the ship, an outline, a struggling beast in the water. Its carcass is spilling cargo, wood splintered and swollen. I gasp. pulling in a breath as I stumble over the rocks. The wind whips the rain against my skin, a sharp spray of cold dashing over my cheekbones. Am I too late? I ask as I reach the group on the beach. A hand fumbles for mine, calloused fingers gripping my own. You're cold, Mira, my father says, blue eyes hidden under the folds of his hood. Take my gloves when you go in. I nod, avoiding the fact that we both know I don't need them. That as soon as I hit the water, I will no longer feel the cold. Moving towards the line, I find my place along the length of slick rope. Six others are with me, six other islanders who have the song of the sea in their blood, who can endure in the ocean and not succumb to her ways so easily. But none of them can last as long as I can. None of them can find warmth beneath the waves. I touch the rope, the rasp of the twine biting into my palms, waking me, igniting the fire in my blood. I look out at the ship, imagine the dying gasps of the sailors. My heart lurches, prickles of heat shivering through my veins. I was born for this, the tide and the foam and the cold. I'm ready.
Yeah, last time we spoke, Compass and Blade was on its way out. Now, as we're speaking, the second book in the trilogy is due out in a couple of months' time. Tell us about Compass and Blade.
Yes, so Compass and Blade came out at the end of February, and it's just been the most incredible experience so far. We had a Locked Library edition. Locked Library is a book box that produces these gorgeous special editions. We had a Waterstone special edition, and it's been stocked in bookshops all across the world. It was also the pick for Barnes & Noble in America, which was a huge surprise and privilege. So it introduced a lot of readers to the series. And in Shadow and Tide, which is also out at the end of this coming February 2025, I actually introduced a new point of view, which will mean that we move beyond the kind of confines of Mira's known world, further out into the world that surrounds her. And the way that I've done that is I've brought in the perspective of a witch. There are witches and magical creatures in this world. And this particular witch, Brielle, she actually hunts magical creatures. So when we're introduced to her, that's what she's doing. And I wanted to, what I always love doing in my books is introducing ideas that could be slightly controversial. And so she's a morally grey character, which makes her very human. And she's questioning what she's doing, why she's doing it, whether she should be loyal to her coven, and ultimately informs some of her decisions further down the line as the tension kind of escalates around Mira in the book.
The roar of the sea echoes in my chest, and I beat my feet against the sand in step with the others. We work as one, and I match my rhythm to theirs. We haven't lost any of us, any of the seven who swim out to the wrecks this season, or last. On three, all together! The answering call goes up all around as we shout back Kai's words. All together. My father appears beside me as we walk, tugging his gloves over my hands, gripping my shoulder. I'll be fine, I say, turning back to the tide. He says nothing, but I feel his love, the ghost of it lingering as he disappears into the night. It wraps round me, a little too stifling. The first lash of sea batters against my thighs, reaching for my chest. I take a deep breath, keeping the rope tangled in my fist. Then, in a rush of fire and ice, I dive under. Agnes surfaces first, just ahead of me. Her red hair flashes, floating like a beacon. I keep her in sight as I work through the waves, feeling out their song, feeling for their pull and beat. The sea is a fickle creature, and on a night like this, she can be wicked and cruel.
A clip of Lizzie Waterworth reading from Compass and Blade, available both commercially and from RNIB Talking Books, as is One Christmas Morning. If the Woodsmoke Woman's Book of Spells isn't in the RNIB library just yet, it will be on its way very soon. And Rachel, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Now on Read On, a trip to the RNIB library to find some brand new audiobooks.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books library. So here are two new gems. First this week we have Glorious Exploits by Ferdia Lennon, which was donated by Penguin Random House.
We set out with six skins, four of water and two of wine, a pot of olives and two blocks of that smelly cheese Ma makes. Ah, it's a beautiful island we have. And sometimes I think the factory closing is my chance to shake things up. That I might just leave Syracuse and find myself a little place by the sea. No more dark rooms, clay and red hands, but the sea and the sky. And when I come home with a fresh catch slung over my shoulder, she'll be there, whoever she may be, waiting for me and laughing. That laugh, I hear it now, and it sounds to me a soft and delicate thing. Why, Gellon, I feel so good today. Gellon looks at me. He's handsome, with eyes the colour of shallow sea when the sun shines through it. He opens his mouth to speak, but nothing comes. He's often down, Gellon. Sees the world as if it's filtered through smoke. No brightness to anything. We walk on.
It's 412 BC, and Athens' invasion of Sicily has failed catastrophically. Thousands of Athenian soldiers are held captive in the quarries of Syracuse, starving, dejected, and hanging on by the slimmest of threads. Lampo and Gellon are local potters, young men with no work and barely two obols to rub together. With not much to fill their time, they take to visiting the nearby quarry, where they discover prisoners who will, in desperation, recite lines from the plays of Euripides in return for scraps of bread and a scattering of olives. And so an idea is born. The men will put on Medea in the quarry, a proper performance to be sung of down the ages, because, after all, you can hate the Athenians for invading your territory, but still love their poetry. But as the performance draws near and the audacity of their enterprise dawns on them, it becomes difficult to distinguish between enemies and friends, and Lampo, whose ambitions have never stretched beyond having enough coin for the next jug of wine, finds his aspirations elevated, his heart entangled, and his courage tested in ways he could never have imagined. Glorious Exploits is an exhilarating and fiercely original story of brotherhood, war, and art.
Even though the Athenians are crushed, their ships firewood and their unburied dead food for our dogs, there are still hoplites on patrol, just in case. Diocles gave a speech not yesterday about how you can never tell with these Athenians. A fresh batch could arrive any day. Maybe he's right. Most of the Spartans have left. Word is they're heading for Athens itself, all set to siege it upright and proper, end this war. But there's still a few about, homesick and useless. In fact, four of them walk ahead of us now, their red cloaks trailing behind them like wounds. Morning! They look back. Only one of them salutes. Arrogant, these Spartans, but I'm feeling good. Down with Athens! Two of them salute now, but there's no life behind it. They look tired and sad, like Gellon. I feel so happy today. I can't explain it, but it's some feeling. Those are the best ones. The ones you can't explain. And we haven't even fed the Athenians.
Glorious Exploits by Ferdia Lennon is read by the author and runs for 8 hours 16 minutes.
We have one of the latest books in the Simon Scarrow Eagles of the Empire series, with more to follow in the future. This one is called The Honour of Rome.
There's a boat approaching, Centurion Macros said, and pointed down the river. The grey-streaked curls above his brows stirred in the cold breeze as he squinted over the water. The others on the deck of the Dolphin turned to see a small low craft being propelled by four men at the oars, while another three sat in the stern and one more stood in the bows, holding a rope to steady himself. It had rounded a bend in the Thamesis, no more than a quarter of a mile away, and was approaching fast. Macro swiftly calculated that it would soon overtake the sluggish merchant vessel, carrying his wife and himself upriver to Londinium. Although the men wore no armour, and Macro could see no spears or other weapons, something about their demeanour caused a wary tingle at the back of his neck.
"Are we in any danger?"
He turned to his wife, Petronella, a heavily built woman with an oval face fringed with dark hair, who was only a little shorter than Macro. They had been together for a few years now, and she knew that, though Macro had left the army, his senses were well honed to detect any potential threat.
"I doubt it. But better to be safe than sorry, eh?"
15 years after he fought Britannia's barbarians during the Roman invasion, Centurion Macro is back. There is restlessness among the tribes that have supposedly accepted Roman rule, while the atmosphere in Londinium is menacing. Newly discharged from the army, Macro is missing the drama of battle, but soon he will need all his courage and skills to survive. Gangs of thugs run the city. When Macro resists, a brutal attack serves as punishment and warning. But the mobsters have made a deadly error. Britannia's veterans stand with their own, and Macro will soon have a powerful ally, Prefect Cato. They will fight to the death to protect the honour of Rome.
He left Petronella to watch the approaching boat and addressed the captain of the merchant vessel in a casual tone.
"A word with you, Andricus."
The captain caught the warning look in Macro's eye and followed him aft to where the baggage lay, covered by a goatskin. Macro folded the covering back and undid the latch of the chest holding his kit. Reaching inside, he rummaged for his sword belt, then quickly buckled it on, adjusting it so that the handle of the sword settled into its usual place against his hip. He handed a spare sword belt to Andricus.
"Put it on."
"They look harmless enough. Are weapons really necessary?"
"Let's hope not. But in my experience, it's better to have them at the ready and not need them than not have them ready and need them."
Andricus took a moment to digest the comment before he took the belt and hurriedly fastened it around his slim hips.
"Now what?" "Let's see what they do."
The Honour of Rome by Simon Scarrow is read by Jonathan Keeble and runs for 12 hours 29 minutes.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Murder Under the Sun, written by Agatha Christie.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Brazil by Michael Palin.
Every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. enjoy a classic from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Black Beauty by Anna Sewell.
Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte.
Plus, you can enjoy A Book for the Younger Listener or Young at Heart every Saturday at 9 a.m. with a repeat on Sundays at 3 p.m. and Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
Alice's Adventures in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll.
Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery.
Enjoy your favourite talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.
And now on Read On, a return visit from the blind poet Dave Steele. He's a luminary figure in poetry, advocacy and global impact, embarking on this extraordinary odyssey after being diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa, or RP, in 2014. I spoke to him on World Sight Day, the day a new book in his Austin's Amazing Adventure series came out called The Big Test. But before we hear Dave's new book, let's hear Dave's brand new poem. For World Sight Day, it's called Last of Sight, and it's about Dave preparing to lose the last of his useful vision.
So this is a poem called Last of Sight. Although I'm at the last of sight, it's not the last of me. There's so much more than just the way these broken eyes can see. It's not the end of beauty when all I see is haze. It's not the end of vision, for in my mind that stays. I will not waste a moment. I will not lose myself. Just because my eyes are blind doesn't mean I'm in poor health. I know that I've adapted to everything before. I made a promise to myself, won't hide behind this door. For years I've been preparing for what is soon to come. And even though I've stumbled, there's far more times I've won. So I won't fear tomorrow. I'm ready as can be. Right now might be the last of sight, but it's not the last of me.
So released today on World Sight Day is the big test part of Austin's amazing adventures by the blind poet Dave Steele. Listening back to some of the interviews, am I right in saying it's now 10 years since your diagnosis?
Yeah, well, it was 10 years in April. So yeah, that 10-year mark now. But really, really proud of kind of this journey that I've come on and where I am today and how I feel about it.
Now, assuming that someone listening hasn't heard you before, how did it all begin for the blind poet?
As you just said, 10 years ago, I was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa officially because I knew I had it in my family. But I was always told it was, you know, wasn't going to affect me till I was much, much older. And I kind of got on with my life and worked for many years as a singer and was kind of living all over the place and, you know, living out of bags and touring around the world. 10 years ago, on a routine eye exam, I was officially diagnosed and my life kind of changed from there. Went through a really kind of tough 8 or 9 months of coming to terms and trying to adjust and being let down by the system, and then found this ability to write about everything that me and my family were going through in poetry. And when I started to post these poems on social media, I started to get messages from people all over the world saying that they were using my poems as a way for them to explain how they were feeling to their loved ones. And it was helping them to kind of come to terms with what they were going through as well. So that kind of gave me my purpose back. And kind of fast forward now, you know, 10 years later, I've written 4 books, which have been like number ones in America and Australia. I'm now known as the blind poet and people use my poetry all over the world as a means of support.
Those books are Stand By Me RP.
Yeah, so there was 3 volumes of that. And then there was also a previous Austin's Amazing Adventures, which has been kind of redone as I signed a publishing deal late last year with actually a friend of R&IB, someone that you'll be familiar with, a guy by the name of Rabin Dutta, who was one of the inventors of the Pen Friend.
And I believe the big test, the new Austin's Amazing Adventure, works with the Pen Friend.
That's correct, yeah. When I initially had the idea for this book series, actually it was sparked from a news article I read by the famous author Julia Donaldson, who's a children's author who wrote books like The Gruffalo and Stick Man and Room on a Broom, all short poetry stories, which I always read with my son Austin. And she did this article saying that basically there needs to be more children with disabilities featured in children's stories to give them that representation. So as soon as I read that article, I kind of wrote 6 books in one night. It just fell out of me. And I just started to sculpt together this book series using my son Austin as the main character. And in the book, he's a young visually impaired boy going to a mainstream school. And it's about breaking down social barriers, not just for children with low vision and blindness, but for anyone with disabilities or additional needs. It's about giving that much needed representation within fun stories.
And you narrated the book as well. How was that?
Yeah, brilliant. You know, I always people say to me when they hear my poems that, you know, the way I read them, because of my previous background with, you know, being a singer, the emotion that I get through is something that they really, you know, identify with. So I loved kind of going into the studio and reciting them. And not only does the book come in large print with audio, you know, with image descriptions for every illustration, but also there's a free audio version, which is available via a QR code. And then, as I said, it's also, you know, with the Pen Friend as well, where you can touch the page and it will also read out the text and it will also read out the image descriptions of the illustrations.
That's what I was going to ask. You don't need a Pen Friend to hear the audio version?
No, not at all. I wanted to make sure that the whole series is completely accessible for all. And that was always my vision right from the start. And not only that, the future books as well, it's not just around sight loss. We have characters within the stories with things like autism, ADHD, wheelchair use, and in any kind of child that you would see walking into any mainstream school, I want it to reflect a true, you know, representation of what it's like for children these days. When Austin was just 5, his sight began to disappear. But like his dad, he wasn't sad and felt no need to fear. For Austin's dad had shown him that the vision in his mind could overcome the obstacles of slowly going blind.
So if anyone wants to find out more, where can they go?
So you can go to either my website, which is theblindpoet.net, or you can go to TouchSpot Audio.
Dave Steele, thank you so much.
Thanks for so much having me, Robert. Speak to you soon.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
Thanks again to Dave Steele. We'll have the books of Rachel Greenlaw's life in a moment, but first, let's take another trip into the RNIB Library.
Another reader favourite is Katie Flynn. Forgotten Dreams has just been added to the library.
It was a hot afternoon in August, and Lottie Lacey was sitting on the top step of No. 2 Victoria Court, staring unseeingly ahead of her whilst her tongue checked her small pearly teeth, as it had done so often this past week. Of course, the result was always the same. She had a wobbler. Several of her friends had already lost some baby teeth, which was not unusual at 7 years old, but they could regard such a loss with equanimity. Some even put the tooth under their pillow and next day found it gone and a round brown penny in its place. But even if their parents could not afford to hand out pennies whenever a tooth came out, there would be no dire consequences for the tooth losers. Lottie, however, knew her own case to be very different, for her mother had impressed upon her the importance of looking sweet. It was one of the first prerequisites for a child star, a subject on which Mammy had been very bitter recently. For while Lottie had been in hospital, she'd been forced to employ another little girl to appear nightly in the current production at the Gaiety Theatre just off the Scotland Road. But Merle sang flat and could not be persuaded to mime her songs, so she'd been told to go. Consequently, Mammy had had to do a solo act until Lottie had been well enough to perform once more.
Lottie and her mother Luella share a house in Victoria Court with Mr. Magic and his son Baz. Lottie is a child star dancing and singing at the Gaiety Theatre to an enraptured audience. Luella acts as Max Magic's assistant. But a road accident causes Lottie to lose her memory. Luella tries to help, but the white mist remains. Then Lottie meets a boy with golden brown eyes who calls her sassy and accuses her of running away. It is after this meeting that the dreams start, dreams of another life, almost another world, and Lottie, sharing them with Baz, begins to believe he knows more than he chooses to tell.
Sweetness, however, was not merely a matter of small, pearly teeth. It encompassed hair as well. Lottie's hair was brown and straight, but her mammy had decided that it simply would not do.
"You see, Queen, when you're part of a double act, a mother and daughter act like you and me, then it's best to look alike," she'd said, giving her appealing smile and twisting a strand of Lottie's hair into a ringlet. "So, this very evening, I'll lighten your hair up a bit. It won't take more than an hour, and I'll buy a comic paper so that you've got something to read while the peroxide works." She'd smiled lovingly at her daughter. "Then you'll be as fair as me, and the audience won't ever know that we aren't both true blondes." That had been when Lottie was only six. But even at six, she'd been well aware that Mammy was no more a true blonde than herself. She had not been tempted to comment, however, for Mammy could be reduced to tears or temper when unpalatable facts were pointed out. So Lottie had submitted to a long evening of boredom and discomfort, whilst her mother covered her hair in a thick white paste, then rinsed and shampooed, and finally rubbed her head briskly before settling her on the hearthrug before the fire to dry out. Later, Lottie had looked in the mirror and had been shocked to find her hair not merely lighter, but as yellow as her mother's. She'd hated it at first, but soon grew accustomed, though it was a nuisance having to have her roots done every few weeks. "Stage lighting is strong, and it wouldn't do for you to come on half brown and half blonde," her mother had explained. "But like most theatricals, I am a perfectionist, so even though it's a bother, I shall make sure you always look your best, as I do myself."
Forgotten Dreams by Katie Flynn is read by Anne Dover and runs for 13 hours and 4 minutes.
For those in the mood for something more thrilling, we have The House in Rye Lane by Susan Allott, which was donated by HarperCollins.
It was the day of the murder, a dark Wednesday in South London, and Diana was listening to the lodgers. They were on the staircase, all three of them. She couldn't see them from the ground floor, but she heard them clearly. She felt their shock. Lee Delaney was shouting orders at his wife and child. There was fear in his voice, in the quiet of the house. One of them whimpered and puked on the carpet. "Do you hear me?" Lee said. Ruth and Cookie replied that they did. He ran up to the next floor, told them not to move. Diana listened. She located the mother and son from their voices. They were together on the stairs, halfway up. Out on the street, she heard rain bouncing off the tarmac, a car horn on the far side of the Rye. A door slammed at the top of the house. Cookie spoke, frightened words that Diana didn't catch. But she knew his voice with its adolescent tremor. She pictured him, stooped and awkward in his school uniform, all at odds with himself. "That strange boy." "Let me think," Ruth said to her son. "Be quiet a minute."
2008. The house Maxine and Seb have just bought was a bargain. A huge Georgian townhouse on the edge of Peckham Rye. It needs a lot of work, but Max couldn't resist it. Now they are in, though, nothing seems to be going right. And as the problems mount up, Max starts to doubt her relationship as well as her decision. Is Seb all he seems to be? And why are the neighbours so evasive about the house's previous owner? 1994. Cookie and his parents have been forced by his dad's gambling debts to move into the attic room of a big old house as lodgers. Tensions run high between them and their elderly landlady, and there's something odd about the place that Cookie can't quite put his finger on. 1843. Horatio built this house for his beloved wife, who then died in mysterious circumstances. After a second death on the premises, both his servants and the locals are starting to talk. Horatio's grief is tinged with shame and guilt. What is he hiding? And will the house ever be free of his legacy?
Diana wished she had never let them into her house. This family with all their problems. But you couldn't pick and choose lodgers in this part of town. And the house put most normal people off. She had lived here all her life, as had all the Lloyds before her. Not because it was a beloved family home, but because no one had ever managed to sell it. It had been grand once, apparently. But nothing had ever gone right in the house on Rye Lane. It was a house of mistakes, of luck turned bad, of love gone cold. Most people knew that before they got through the door. Ruth stepped down into the hallway. Diana heard her shoes on the tiles, the skim of her shower-proof coat. Ruth despised her. Diana had cottoned on to this too late. She'd thought Ruth was reserved, a bit surly. But it ran deeper than that, and stronger, more poisonous for being suppressed. It had scared her when it rose to the surface. "Don't look down," Ruth said to Cookie as he followed her. But Cookie looked. His face was the last face Diana would see, his pale fright at the sight of her.
The House on Rye Lane by Susan Allott is read by Tom Babbage, Tim Bruce and Coral Sinclair and runs for 8 hours 58 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
And finally, on today's show, a return to Rachel Greenlaw, author of the Woodsmoke Woman's Book of Spells, for the Books of Her Life. So, is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
There is, and I'm going to cheat a little bit here and say it was a series, and it was the His Dark Materials series by Philip Pullman. There is something about those books that have stayed with me for years, and I think it's the fact that Philip Pullman writes such rich worlds and such interesting characters that are placed in these worlds that explore them. He looks at all sorts of questions of life, morality, and he puts them in such a way that they're accessible for that age group, but also as adults, we can read between the lines and we think about it completely differently. So they kind of, these books have a universal appeal, a timeless appeal, and I still think about them a lot, and I think I probably need to reread them. And I would say that they are the kind of books that I would love to, they're the kind of books that I think of when I'm creating fantasy worlds, and I think if I could ever create something as timeless and effective as what Philip Pullman created in that series, that would be job done for the rest of my life.
Gentlemen, I feel sure I speak for all of us when I bid Lord Asriel welcome. His visits are rare, but always immensely valuable. And I understand he has something of particular interest to show us tonight. This is a time of high political tension, as we are all aware. Lord Asriel's presence is required early tomorrow morning in Whitehall, and a train is waiting with steam up ready to carry him to London as soon as we have finished our conversation here, so we must use our time wisely. When he has finished speaking to us, I imagine there will be some questions. Please keep them brief and to the point. Lord Asriel, would you like to begin?
Thank you, Master. To start with, I have a few slides to show you. Sub-Rector, you can see best from here, I think. Perhaps the Master would like to take the chair near the wardrobe.
Lyra marvelled at her uncle's skill. The old Sub-Rector was nearly blind, so it was courteous to make room for him nearer the screen, and his moving forward meant that the Master would be sitting next to the librarian, only a matter of a yard or so from where Lyra was crouched in the wardrobe. As the Master settled in the armchair, Lyra heard him murmur,
"The devil. He knew about the wine, I'm sure of it."
The librarian murmured back,
"He's going to ask for funds, if he forces a vote."
"If he does that, we must just argue against, with all the eloquence we have."
The lantern began to hiss as Lord Asriel pumped it hard. Lyra moved slightly so that she could see the screen where a brilliant white circle had begun to glow. Lord Asriel called,
"Could someone turn the lamp down?"
One of the scholars got up to do that and the room darkened. Lord Asriel began,
"As some of you know, I set out for the North 12 months ago on a diplomatic mission to the King of Lapland. At least, that's what I pretended to be doing. In fact, my real aim was to go further north still, right onto the ice, in fact, to try and discover what had happened to the Grumman expedition. One of Grumman's last messages to the Academy in Berlin spoke of a certain natural phenomenon only seen in the lands of the North. I was determined to investigate that, as well as find out what I could about Grumman. But the first picture I'm going to show you isn't directly about either of those things."
And he put the first slide into the frame and slid it behind the lens. A circular photogram in sharp black and white appeared on the screen. It had been taken at night under a full moon, and it showed a wooden hut in the middle distance, its walls dark against the snow that surrounded it and lay thickly on the roof.
There are many Philip Pullman books available from RNIB Talking Books. That was a clip from Northern Lights, narrated by Philip Pullman with Ruth Wilson and a full cast. And is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
Yes, and it's a book that I actually really enjoy listening to on audiobook. I've listened to it a couple of times now. It is Yellowface by R.F. Kuang, and it is such an interesting book, and it's written in such a way that it's kind of chatty, it's very accessible, it's a thriller, but it's a literary thriller, And some of the kind of inner monologue of the main character is incredibly shocking. And she just, you know, it's just thrown out there as if, like, yeah, it means nothing. And you kind of have to just listen again and think, no, she definitely thinks that way. And I love listening to that audiobook. It just, you know, whilst I'm doing the dishes or going for a walk or, yeah, curled up. And I think that there's so much to unpack from that book still.
The night I watched Athena Liu die, we're celebrating her TV deal with Netflix. Off the bat, for this story to make sense, you should know two things about Athena. First, she has everything. A multi-book deal straight out of college at a major publishing house, an MFA from the one writing workshop everyone's heard of, a resume of prestigious artist residencies, and a history of awards nominations longer than my grocery list. At 27, she's published 3 novels, each one a successively bigger hit. For Athena, the Netflix deal was not a life-changing event, just another feather in her cap. One of the side perks of the road to literary stardom she's been hurtling down since graduation. Second, perhaps as a consequence of the first, she has almost no friends. Writers our age, young, ambitious, up-and-comers just this side of 30, tend to run in packs. You'll find evidence of cliques all over social media. Writers gushing over excerpts of one another's unpublished manuscripts. Losing my head over this WIP. Squealing over cover reveals. This is so gorgeous, I will die. And posting selfies of group hangs at literary meetups across the globe. But Athena's Instagram photos feature no one else. She regularly tweets career updates and quirky jokes to her 70,000 followers, but she rarely adds other people. She doesn't name drop, doesn't blurb or recommend her colleagues' books, and doesn't publicly rub shoulders in that ostentatious, desperate way early career writers do. In the entire time I've known her, I've never heard her reference any close friends but me. I used to think that she was simply aloof. Athena is so stupidly, ridiculously successful that it makes sense she wouldn't want to mingle with mere mortals. Athena presumably chats exclusively with blue check holders and fellow best-selling authors who can entertain her with their rarefied observations on modern society. Athena doesn't have time to make friends with proletarians. But in recent years, I've developed another theory, which is that everyone else finds her as unbearable as I do. It's hard, after all, to be friends with someone who outshines you at every turn. Probably no one else can stand Athena because they can't stand constantly failing to measure up to her. Probably I'm here because I'm just that pathetic. So that night, it's only Athena and me at a loud, overpriced rooftop bar in Georgetown. She's flinging back cocktails like she has a duty to prove she's having a good time, and I'm drinking to dull the bitch in me that wishes she were dead.
Yellow Face by R.F. Kuang is available both commercially and in R&IB Talking Books, and is read by Helen Laser. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be contemporary, but something you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend.
So the book I'd like to recommend that I've read recently is Cecilia Ahern's Into the Storm, and it follows a doctor in a rural island, and she comes across something on the road on a very, very rainy night, which changes her life forever. It's all about what's going on for her at home in her own life, the decisions she's made, and the repercussions of what happens that night in the storm. It's an excellent portrayal of character, complex characters, and it will take you on a journey that is quite unexpected, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
The rain against the windshield is relentless. It buckets down from the heavens as if somebody or something is angrily and deliberately attempting to wipe them all out, like a demonic toddler with a watering can over an anthole. And you can't see a thing beyond the violent movements of her windshield wipers and the blurry slurry of rain, which is making outside seem like a mirage or melting hot wax, everything dripping, dissolving, and slowly becoming undone. She takes her foot off the accelerator as she whips around another corner she didn't see coming. Her stomach heaves at the sudden lurch and her heart pounds. Her shoulders are tense as she grips the wheel for dear life and her jaw aches as she clamps down her teeth. She slides around the narrow winding roads through the Cruag and Kilmashogue Mountains, lined with stone walls and conifer forest. The slopes are rugged, scattered with granite boulders transported during the Ice Age and dropped erratically, none of which she can see on this darkest of dark nights and the shortest of days, but she knows it's there. She grew up in this neck of the woods, the Dublin Mountains, and homeschooled by her mother, there was no classrooms but fields of lessons. Education was something you touched, tasted, smelled, felt. Even with her knowledge of the roads, she knows she should stop, pull in and wait for the rainstorm to subside. Surely the rain can't keep up like this for much longer. Her headlights occasionally take a snapshot of rapidly racing water down the roadside, running away like a mischief of rats. Ireland will disappear, fade away as if none of them were ever there. A small island in the Atlantic Ocean, finally so saturated it plunges to the ocean floor to lie like a deep water sponge. Bubbles on the surface of the water, the only thing to give away the sunken, soggy civilization.
That's Angeline Ball reading Into the Storm by Cecilia Ahern, available both commercially and from RNIB Talking Books. And once again, Rachel, thank you so much.
Thank you. That was brilliant. Thanks, Robert.
That's all we've got time for on today's show, but remember this show is also available as a podcast. There are over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read On. I'll be back at the same time next week. But remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB Library has to offer. That we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.